Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by social healthcare researcher Dr. Nicholas Christakis. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about an iPad-based tool that's improving communication between doctor and patient in the UK. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Mark Maselli.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea comes to us from Kansas City, where urban farmers are thriving because of an unusual partnership between refugees and local farm programs. In Kansas, several refugee families from Africa and Asia live in a public housing project called Juniper Gardens. When the refugee women from the community began asking Catholic Charities of Northeast Kansas City for a garden, an opportunity arose. Catholic Charities quickly partnered with the Kansas City Center for Urban Agriculture to start the New Roots for Refugee Farm. The program has been operating for over 5 years. The farmers receive a quarter-acre plot after a commitment of at least 1 year with the community garden. Everything is paid for, including seeds, tools, and water. In the winter, farmers take courses in planting, production, and marketing. For many in the participating refugee community, farming is what they know and what they're good at. In a new and unfamiliar place, it not only offers them a sense of self-determination, but healthy food for their families, extra income, and a way to settle into their new community. The Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City, which provides some of the program's financial support, interviewed one woman who used to be a farmer in her homeland of Burundi.
This garden is everything I have. This is the only thing I know in America, so if I don't have my farming or my gardening, I don't know what I will do.
Gradually, the farmers take on more responsibility and ownership of the land. Many go on to run independent farm stands in the community, which enhance the local food system. Helping refugees establish a new way of life that's healthy, sustainable, and connected, now that's a bright idea. Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Nicholas Christakis. Dr. Christakis is known for his research on the social factors that affect health, healthcare, and longevity. He's a professor of medicine, of medical sociology, and of sociology at Harvard University. Welcome, Dr. Christakis.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, you know, your groundbreaking study in 2007 involving social networks and obesity made headlines with your findings that obesity is socially contagious. The study found that someone's likelihood of becoming obese went up by 57% if a friend was obese, 40% if a sibling was, and 37% if a spouse was. In the closest friendships, the risk almost tripled. Can you pull the thread for us, if you will, of where did you get the idea for the study? How did you carry it out? And what can we learn from it today?
I think what was happening around the time when my colleague James Fowler and I began thinking about this around 2002 was that there had been a lot of talk about the obesity epidemic. And it was clear that obesity was epidemic in one meaning of the word, which is that there's more of it than there used to be. You know, even in the last 10 years, we've gone from about 20% of Americans being obese to 30%, and fully two-thirds of Americans are now overweight or obese. And but James and I wondered whether we could understand obesity as an epidemic in the other meaning of the word, not just that there's more of it, but was potentially something spreading from person to person? Was there a literal contagion, not just a metaphoric contagion? And so we wanted to see whether we could find and analyze a kind of data that was not yet widely available at that time, a kind of data that showed people's social interactions, how they were embedded in these face-to-face networks, and a kind of data that also had information about their weight, and data that included both changes in their weight and changes in their social interactions across time. And it was not easy to find data like this. We bumbled, though, across some paper records that had been kept at the Framingham Heart Study, a very famous study that's been ongoing since the 1940s. And we computerized those paper records and were able to reconstruct the social ties among the participants of that study. And as a result, we could see who's whose friend, who's whose neighbor, who's whose spouse, who's whose coworker, who's whose sibling, and map those interactions as they changed across time as people friended and defriended each other, the old-fashioned defriending, like the real face-to-face defriending, not the modern sort of Facebook defriending. And as they married and divorced each other and changed where they lived and so forth, we had all that information. And so as a result, we were able to kind of tease out, how does weight gain in one person, how is it associated with weight gain in other people to whom you are connected? And we used a variety of statistical techniques because there are also a variety of complications here in developing confidence in this assessment. We found evidence that there is an association between your weight and the weight of your friends, your friends' friends, and even your friends' friends' friends, people you don't even know. So that was the first study we published in 2007. And then since then, we've looked at a variety of other phenomena as well. I should say one other thing, actually two other things. First, I should say that we found that both weight gain and weight loss can spread. And second, I should say that our work was intended to describe what was happening in the world. It wasn't intended to be normative. We're not suggesting that that there's, you know, trying to suggest prejudice against people of any one or another body size. We're just trying to understand what is a factor that might have been contributing to this epidemic in our country.
Well, Dr. Christakis, I think you're doing an amazing job of helping people to understand that. And you've also written very compellingly, far from creating prejudice, I think you've written very compellingly about just the impact that other factors, gender, race, ethnicity, education, income level, marital status, all these variables have in health and also in disease. And I was so struck particularly by your writing, and I'm not sure I'm quoting the exact numbers right, but you talked about the hundreds of thousands of lives, maybe 400,000 lives that could be saved each year if people didn't smoke cigarettes. But you also talked about the 200,000 lives that might be saved if everyone achieved a high school education, because education is so strongly associated with health and well-being. How do you see the results of your research being used in public policy beyond healthcare per se, but really to influence the public policy as we look at things like education policy in this country?
Well, I think the data that you were summarizing, first of all, to be clear, is the work of other people that I was describing. That's not my own work. And I think there, what you are describing is a kind of shift in perspective. So usually when we think about the causes of death in our country, we think about, cardiovascular disease is the leading cause, then cancer, then you have a variety of other causes, sort of neurologic diseases, pulmonary diseases, various infections, pneumonia, I think, is number 5 on the list, and so forth. And you go down the list of top 10 causes, Alzheimer's, I think, is 10th on the list, and you get some list of causes of death by disease. But actually, you can think about causes in a completely different way. You can think about causes in terms of the underlying or root causes. And here now we would emphasize things like tobacco exposure. Tobacco is the leading preventable cause of death in our society. You know, about 400,000, 440,000 people die every year, not just from lung cancer, but from other cancers, from burning to death, from inhaling secondhand smoke of other people. Then you can go down the list, alcohol exposure, sort of occupational injuries, environmental toxins, and socioeconomic risk factors. It invites you to begin to think about different priorities for how we go about combating illness in our society, which in turn would invite you to think about different ways of allocating resources. So instead of spending money, let's say, to do research on different kinds of cancers or neurologic diseases in that way, you might want to spend money understanding the behavioral determinants of ill health. I think we spend less than 5% of our research as a country understanding or studying causes the second way I described to you. And 95% of our research dollars, I'm pretty sure, are spent studying causes in the first way I described to you of thinking about causes.
Dr. Christakis, while social economic variables can play a role in disease and health, as you've demonstrated, so can one's social network. You've also been able to shed some light on how social factors can positively impact health. Can you tell us about your work on how groups can drive down smoking rates, as well as how happiness spreads socially?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that, okay, I mean, there are two ideas there buried in that question. One idea is that the reason, you know, because people are connected, their health is connected. And the reason we connect to each other is because the benefits of a connected life outweigh the costs. If I was always violent towards you or made you miserably unhappy or infected you with bad germs or gave you bad health habits or gave you misinformation, you would cut the ties to me and the network would disintegrate. Therefore, the spread of good and desirable things, like ideas, like information, like happiness, like kindness, like love even, are required to sustain and nourish the network. So the reason people stay connected to each other, in fact, the reason we as a species form networks, is that the benefits of a connected life outweigh the cost. So yes, we are harmed by our links to others, but yes, even more, we benefit from our links to others. And this has been shown in numerous ways, with numerous study designs. So and one summary thing to understand is that the more socially isolated you are, the higher your risk of death. So first of all, on a very kind of 30,000-foot level, being socially isolated is not so good for you.
Mm-hmm.
On the second thing that you alluded to, which I'm now losing the thread, remind me that how can you use these things? So there are a number of ways that you can begin to think about exploiting an understanding of human connectedness to enhance our health. And the simple-minded way would be just to realize that, you know, isolation is not good for you. But there are more sophisticated ways as well. So, for example, we know that group-level interventions are more effective than isolated interventions. So to pick a simplistic example, imagine you have $100 and you're trying to get 10 smokers to quit smoking. You could bring them in one at a time and spend $10 on each of them, and perhaps of the 10, one of them might quit. Or you could bring all 10 of them in together and put them in a group and spend $100 on them at once, and perhaps three of them might quit because now they can reinforce and support each other. So for the same 10 people, the same $100, you get three quitters instead of one quitter. This is an example of the ability of group-level phenomena and social network phenomena to provide for positive benefits and to be used in a kind of public policy way. And we have many examples of this now, both old examples, things like Alcoholics Anonymous and Weight Watchers and so forth, which mm-hmm. are kind of artificial social networks, and much, much more sophisticated, bigger and sort of more complex examples nowadays using different kinds of networks.
Dr. Christakis, your work has been constantly evolving, as has technology and also our ideas about social networks. And much of what you have been saying about social networks has been applied to personal face-to-face, as you said, old-fashioned befriending, you know, the real person in front of you, networks. Still an enjoyable way to have friends. But more and more, certainly, when people hear the phrase social network, they're thinking about the online social networks.
Yes.
And there's a great deal of interest in using online social media as a way to track health, influence health, even track the spread of diseases. One of our recent guests, Dr. Mostashari from the Office of the National Coordinator, spoke about monitoring public health using social media. But beyond monitoring, there's also using it to influence and promote it. So as these social networks become more powerful, what's the effect of that technology on us as another form of networking?
Well, most people, when they think about sort of online networks, think of the risks or dangers of the mere use of these networks. They're worried that this will thin out our face-to-face interactions or that people will become addicted to the internet and so forth. But the question you're asking, it's important for people to understand, is different than that. The question you're asking is, to what extent does the availability of this kind of data about where people are situated in a network and what's happening to them, how does that affect the ability of public health officials and others to monitor the population and track and follow and understand what's happening? And the answer is, it's providing us tremendous new tools. You can get early warning about epidemics, for example. In the olden days, you used to have to wait for people to go to the doctor's office. Then the doctor would do some tests. Those tests that would results would be sent to some kind of central monitoring facility. Weeks later, we would know what's going on in terms of the health of a population. Whereas now, people could like literally monitor what's happening online amongst millions of people that are updating their Facebook status, for example. And there's an enormous, enormous effort being made among scientists right now to figure out how valuable, how realistic, how quickly might we exploit information of this type. And I think over the coming years, we're going to see many new tools that take advantage of online data that allow us to, you know, better meet the health needs of the public, to display certain particular kinds of characteristics, and the people within those networks can be affected by those characteristics.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Nicholas Christakis, who researches how social factors affect health, healthcare, and longevity. Talk to us a little bit about the next wave of your research in the area, and are there folks engaged in translational research based on the seminal work that you've done? And also give us a little peek at maybe what some of your students are thinking about, writing about, and researching as well.
Well, my lab is doing, along with my colleague James Fowler's lab, we're engaged in three sorts of major things right now. One thing is we're seeking to understand the biological origins and biological consequences of networks. Like, why do human beings form networks in the first place? Can we understand this from an evolutionary biology perspective? Are there sort of genetic and foundations of human social interaction? The second strand of work is doing experiments with networks, and we think this is an important new area, moving beyond observational studies and moving to do actual experiments where we can be a bit more confident about what's actually happening. And the third thing we're doing is we're trying to start applying some of these techniques. Can we increase the likelihood that villagers in Uganda will use bed nets to prevent malaria? You know, can we find influential individuals in the network and influence their behavior in a way that gets more people to use bed nets? Or can we understand the resistance in communities in India to using certain neonatal health practices? Maybe there are pockets within the networks where people are resistant, and if we understand how networks work, we can deliver these healthcare interventions in a more efficient and effective way.
Dr. Christakis, this also builds off of that a little bit. You know, on the show, we don't usually dive too deep into the science, but I think you've laid out some just brilliant descriptions of how we move from our essential genetic makeup, our genotypes, to how we express our genetic makeup, our phenotypes, to how we might ultimately, not in a day, but over time, influence the genetic makeup of others in our community or be influenced by them. Can you maybe share with our listeners an example of that, or just turn that into kind of everyday language for our listeners?
Well, I don't, to be clear, I didn't just say that your behavior affects other people's genotypes. It's not like your behavior will affect someone else's genes, at least not in real time. We have been exploring that idea over eons, that is to say over tens of thousands of years. Can we find evidence that people's social interactions is affecting the actual genetic constitution of human beings? And there are a bunch of scientists working on related topics right now, and the answer to that seems to be yes, that culture can affect our genes. And one of my favorite examples of this is the persistence of lactase in adults, the ability to digest lactose in adults. That is a valuable ability, and that's a mutation. That's a valuable ability only once human beings have evolved the capacity to domesticate milk-producing animals. And what's been found is that over the last 3,000 to 9,000 years, there have been several cases in which human beings have domesticated milk-producing animals, and then that seems to have led to a selection pressure whereby the people who could take advantage of this milk, grew in number compared to people who could not. And so this is one of my favorite examples of how culture can change our genes, how what we do to the world can feed back and affect us at a very deep level. The broader way that you asked the question was, you know, to what extent can we connect everything from the microscopic biological level to the macroscopic policy level? And I think that's a, you know, that's an aspiration that many scientists hold, is that with better understanding at every level, we can integrate across levels and really understand not only what is happening, but understand how best to, you know, intervene in the world to make it better.
Dr. Christakis, we'd like to ask our guest this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
My goodness, there are lots of people doing very cool things. There's a guy at NYU right now, Sinan Aral, A-R-A-L, who's doing some very cool things looking at online networks. There's some people, Nathan Wolf at the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative in California, and his group are doing some very cool things. There's just so many scholars that are doing what I would consider to be very exciting work. It's hard for me to pick. I'm sure I'm neglecting all my other friends. I wasn't expecting that question. Those are just two people that popped into my mind right now.
Well, we expect everybody in your social network to be fascinating people, so I'm sure there's lots of opportunities to focus on them. Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Nicholas Christakis, known for his research on social networks and the social factors that affect health and healthcare and longevity. Dr. Christakis, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Patient-centered care is taking on a new dimension in the UK. The National Health Service has welcomed a new iPad-based tool that's benefiting both patient and provider. It's called the Tracker.
It provides a supportive mechanism, but primarily that communication on an equal basis between the patient and the doctor.
That's Dr. Matt Jamieson Evans. He joined me via Skype from his London office. He co-founded Health Unlocked, the company that created the tracker. Before venturing into technology, he spent 10 years at the NHS as an orthopedic surgeon. He says he came up with the idea for the tracker as a way to improve his relationships with patients.
I was looking for a way to maximize those precious 10 minutes I have with patients. I'll let them find a way to track their progress online, you know, between my consults and share it with me so that we could actually improve the value of those 10 minutes and actually get to grips with the real problem of sorting out a treatment.
Right now, the technology is being tested in orthopedics. Jamieson Evans says what's unique about something like this is how it can benefit important decisions about care.
Let's say they end up deciding together that they want to go ahead and have these massive operations. Following that operation, they're also allowed to track the progress of that operation and actually using scores which are scientifically validated. So they mean something to the doctors as well as mean something to the patients. They can then decide together how successful that treatment's been.
And that has broad implications for the system too. Not only does shared decision-making engage patients and give them more control over their healthcare, but it's been shown to reduce overall costs in the healthcare system. In a 2009 report prepared for the Commonwealth Fund, the Lewin Group estimates that savings associated with implementing shared decision-making in the Medicare population for 11 conditions alone would be more than $15 billion over 5 years. The data that's generated from the tracker will be able to help shape clinical decisions at the NHS, too. Jamieson Evans says that in this single pilot alone at the National Orthopedic Hospital, 3,000 to 4,000 patients will be recording information this year that's on par with the level of data generated from a clinical trial. Tracker pilots are expected to expand into several other areas of medicine soon. As for coming to our side of the Atlantic, interested parties in the U.S. are said to be taking note.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of connecting our communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.